Interlude. How to be a political columnist. There are two gambits, Peter Quint would say. Here's the problem. If you write what you believe and stay consistent, your readers will quickly get sick of you. They'll know what you're going to say before you've said it. Why should they read on? One answer was to keep on saying it, only ever more vividly. But that meant saying it more extremely. Trouble was, you ended up ranting, stuck in fourth gear with your extreme viewpoint and unable to reverse neatly back into common sense. This he called liddling. The alternative was to change your view regularly and pick subjects the readers didn't expect. Keep moving. Zigzag. The danger then was becoming a professional and therefore wearisome, contrarian. Everyone thought the Russian president a dangerous lunatic? Then your job was to warmly defend him. Popular opinion was turning against Alwyn Grimaldi. As one of his long-standing critics, you leapt to his defence. This also had a limited shelf life, though longer than the alternative. It was more interesting. Quint called it the Jenkins Gambit. During his salad years, Peter Quint had tried both. He had swung back and forth in his defence of Labour and the Tories, never predictable but never taken quite seriously either. He had snarled, spat, and confected anger. He could be quite good. But the truth was that he was too comfortable, too thoroughly pleased with himself to be convincingly angry. So he learned to oil. Again, the boy was good. He had buttery, palm-oily skin. His hair was oily. He became a sucker, a climbing vine. Extreme left-wingers and staunch conservatives felt his slick attentiveness coil itself around them and assumed he was a genuine admirer. Sometimes he was. His columns were full of gossip he picked up from hanging around beside people at parties. For that reason, they were worth reading. Anyone on the up or who held a position of power or influence, a senior civil servant, a flavour of the month broadcaster, all ministers and shadow ministers, would be slobberingly flattered. But everybody else, those who were beginning to fall from favour, those who clearly would never make it right to the top, the averagely intelligent backbenchers, would feel the lash of Quint's contempt. For Peter Quint was an admirer of power, not of politics. Increasingly he felt that anybody who had gone to all the tedious trouble of getting him or herself elected was self-evidently a moron. A well-paid journalist, who'd never been elected, who'd never tried to steer anything bigger than a moderately sized lawnmower, had, he felt, the right, the duty, to look down on MPs from a great height. And looking down was what Peter did second best. He hung on the system like a growth, oiling up and pissing down. The master was Peter's oldest and still most influential source. These days he rarely got to speak to him directly, but the master had plenty of excellent go-betweens, from former ministers like Murdoch White to sexy, intriguing Ella James. It was obviously clear to Peter that Ella and the master were more than colleagues, although it was equally clear that this was in a category of information never to be relayed to his readers. But the master had been making Peter Quint's life hard over the past few months. For reasons Peter had not yet got to the bottom of, the master was constantly promoting rising Labour MPs Peter had never heard of, but was now obliged to praise in his columns. Ella would make a call. "You might take a look at the new member for Neath. We'd be ever so grateful." The problem was, they rarely lasted long. First there had been Facey Romford, a fresh-faced farming socialist. Interesting. He was handsome, he spoke well, but, it later turned out, he had a penchant for bondage and sadomasochism. Photographs were produced. No more Facey Romford. Then there have been the reformed Islamist Abu al-Britani, a bright and compelling spokesman for community tolerance and moderation. He'd even spoken out against the veil. Al-Britani, however, turned out to have been working for IS all along. He was apprehended at a royal garden party with a bomb inserted in his back passage. He and it were removed to a safe part of Green Park and ignited. Some well-bred trees were damaged. Then there was Annie Baldwin, a feisty girl. But then came Zebragate, and the animal rights people made sure that Annie returned to obscurity. Soon the Peter Quint column was being mocked each fortnight by Private Eye for its promotion of brilliant New Labour MPs who then mysteriously imploded, except for those who exploded. Private Eye called it the Curse of Quint. But Quint wasn't the word the magazine used. It had childishly renamed him. Peter hated all this. He hated it so much that he affected to regard it as simply a bit of light-hearted fun, and even went along to a Private Eye lunch to show what a good sport he was. The lunch was held in a former reform school for wayward girls in Greek Street, Soho, where the food was excellent, and only the shifty and dishevelled nature of the diners hinted at what was really going on. Unfortunately, Ian Hislop, the then editor, announced Peter to the assembled gathering as our good friend Peter Cunt. Shunning a tempting-looking salmon souffle, Peter stormed out. Had he been a bolder soul, he might have cut his connections with the master there and then. But Ella had been flattering and persuasive, and the master's wife had condescended to have lunch with him. It was at around this time that he got the story about Ulwin Grimaldi's sister. Now Peter found himself boosting the career of a young and determined new Scottish MP called David Petrie. And this time it seemed the master was on the money. Petrie had barely put a foot wrong, and was already widely tipped to be heading for better things. It occurred to Peter that his column would be stronger if it had a villain as well as a hero. Well before her invitation to the US ambassador, he had wondered whether that uppity lesbian Caroline Phillips was getting much too easy a ride elsewhere in the media. Their evening together strengthened his dislike. She was arrogant, self-assured, and she thought a free evening out would win him, Peter Quint, over. So the next morning, he began to go for her, just the odd phrase and sentence to start with. Quint was far too intelligent and astute to attack Caro's sexuality or her apparently strong religious views, but he did make it clear that he suspected her growing reputation was based on the pathetic susceptibilities of the male politicians around her, a weakness that Mr. Peter Quint, for one, did not share. Though he did like his tummy to be tickled, that was true. In the Rose Garden,